Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Full Service Radio.
Okay, and we have a special little featurette. This is not something we've done before, but we thought this would be cool, especially in light of our last couple of guests.
It's a special recording of a panel discussion of five actually notable wine experts and non-wine experts, actually, all discussing, you know, the exploration and intersection of taste and identity. It's a collaboration between the DC Public Library and Domestique Wine, probably one of our favorite natural wine bars here in the district.
It was super interesting, and I think a lot of really unique points and perspectives kind of came out of it. But in the panel, we had John Bonnet, wine writer and editor at Punch.
Your former boss.
My former boss, yeah, from the Chronicle.
Lee Campbell, a sommelier and wine consultant up in Brooklyn, New York. She's done a lot of work for Andrew Tarlow's restaurants.
W. Ralph Eubanks, author, professor, and at University of Mississippi.
Millicent Soares, she's a cook and a writer. She wrote a great piece for Bon Appetit in May about her leaving the restaurant scene to cook for the underserved.
And our very own Genevieve Villamora, co-owner of Bad Saint.
And the entire discussion was moderated by Janine Copeland, former general manager at Dio Wine Bar.
So anyways, we thought it was really cool, and we're excited to put it out there for you. So hold on to your butts.
My name is Genevieve Villamora. I'm a Chicago native, but have been living in Washington, D.C. for 25 years. I started my professional working life after college in nonprofits for a decade, and restaurants is my second career, so I've been working in restaurants now for about a decade as well, and I'm a co-owner of a small Filipino restaurant in Columbia Heights called Bad Saint. I would say that the way that taste and identity relate to my life are in a very, very literal way, in that I think what may be the case for me that may not be the case for a lot of restaurants in the city, especially as the restaurant scene is really growing exponentially, is that I feel like the restaurant is a very personal statement in a way. In that I grew up Filipino-American and have really spent a lot of my life trying to tease out what exactly that means for me, and it just so happens that this restaurant is sort of the embodiment of that journey.
I'm Ralph Eubanks. I'm kind of the odd academic here in the room. So I teach at the University of Mississippi in Southern Studies. I'm a writer, editor. I live in D.C., so I really have a pretty divided identity. I have one foot in the South and one foot in the Northeast. So I'm kind of pulled between these two places, and depending on where I am, there will be a certain way that I will convey that identity. So this really spoke to me because you may not even hear me drop a y'all tonight because I know that I'm not in that world. But I also, you know, since I teach Southern Studies and I also teach literature, I'm thinking about identity. You know, we have as many ways of thinking about identity as we have ways of interpreting a poem. And that's something that I really want us to think about, that so all these, there are all these various markers of identity that come up that I often write about. Generally, I write about race and identity, but being back in the South, I'm thinking a lot more about kind of my regional identity, and I should say regional identities, because it depends on where I am, which one I am going to put on.
My name is John Bonnet. I'm a journalist and author. Mostly focused on wine, some food as well. These days, I predominantly write books. I write for an online magazine called Punch, which is focused on sort of the world of beverages. For a long time, I was the wine editor and chief wine critic at the San Francisco Chronicle. And so wine is interesting because there are truly very, very few people who can come to wine with anything that is more than a blank slate, which is to say, I actually grew up in a family that drank wine pretty regularly, and I drank it well below the age of being able to do so legally. But that is not most people's experience. Wine is something that comes really with the opportunity for enormous discovery, and the idea of sweet and dry, specifically from the wine space, is fascinating because it has almost everything to do with the identity that people choose for themselves and their own taste and what they wish to convey out into the world. The more complicated part for me, not even so much with wine, but with my sort of professional role, is that I was the quote-unquote tastemaker. And so, whereas often people would say, well, you know, your taste is what you choose it to be, I was the one who actually said, actually, no, I am the guy who says this is good and this is bad. But when you take on that responsibility, you have to at some point understand it's not objective, no matter what anyone wishes it to be. Wine critics spend a lot of time talking about objectivity, which is the biggest load of crap I've ever heard. And one of the things that I really, sort of my last few years at the Chronicle and afterwards, I started talking about a lot was that that you have to own your own implicit biases, you have to own your subjectivity, and you have to be able to communicate the place that you come from in terms of your taste and your identity, so that people may agree with you and they may not, but you can say, you know, I've done this for a while, this is my expertise, and I'm going to share with you what I think succeeds and what doesn't, but by no means am I casting judgment from on high. So it's been, for me, in terms of identity, an interesting journey, because as the guy who actually had to sort of go out and make these would-be proclamations, often wrong, it was a question of owning a sense of both responsibility and also my own limitations.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Lee Campbell. I'm based in New York, based in Brooklyn. And I work as a sommelier consultant. My project right now is I'm working with an estate in Madison, Virginia called Early Mountain. And I just finished co-organizing a wild ferment beer cider wine festival in Austin. I came to this business after spending a little bit more time working as a maitre d' and a manager of restaurants, eventually sort of segued into wine, as many of us do. And I was always very confident of my abilities in certain spheres. I knew that I could taste, and I knew that I had distinct opinions about what tasted good and how things should taste. I grew up with a grandmother who was very well-known in Jamaica for writing cookbooks and taught me a lot about flavor, and I cooked with her as a child. But in terms of moving into a wine world where I didn't see a whole lot of people that looked like me, it was very hard to kind of develop the confidence to not just trust the palate that I had developed over my life, but then to evolve into a wine taster who was confident in her palate. I can say that my early days were very much formed by my participation in what's called the natural wine industry, the natural wine world. Some might argue, and I might argue, that it's a kinder, gentler place to develop your palate because it's a little edgy. It was a little, especially when I was starting out, it was a little wonky, and we all spent a lot of time trying to figure out what we were excited about and what this natural wine thing was that we were trying to promote. At this point, it's become a little bit more established, and so I don't know if it's as easy to be that person in that aspect of the wine world as it was when I was starting out. But when I came into it, that seemed an easier way in than the very reserved, elitist, classical way to get into wine. So I was always going to be more interested in sort of natural winemakers in the Loire Valley than I was in Bordeaux producers. And that was really comforting to me. But things have evolved and things have changed a bit. And I think, like so many people, as wine professionals, we're always trying to find our relevance and trying to find our voice.
Thank you. My name is Millicent Source, and I'm not a wine professional. I'm a cook, and I live in New York, and I work at a soup kitchen, the largest emergency food provider in Brooklyn called St. John's Bread and Life in Bed-Stuy. And I started there, like, right after that really great election. And I worked on a program to train people for jobs in kitchens, and then we did a year of that, and now I'm working there. Now I'm still there. That program's no longer there, but I'm still there working on kind of taking that. I'm a cook, so I've worked in restaurants, so kind of taking more of a restaurant chef point of view towards the operations there, because there's so much food involved, you know. So I think I've always thought about taste and identity, because I've cooked for a long time, and I've always felt like I'm a good worker, you know, and so my taste has evolved through exposure. I think people's tastes evolve through exposure and learning, like if it's your job. So I've always felt sort of set out from where I've worked that I have to catch up. I grew up in a restaurant and a bar in Towson, Maryland, and also on a farm, and I come at food from, I don't know, more of a very working class rather than super visionary point of view. So for me, like, getting older and understanding more about taste and identity, and then working in a soup kitchen and being around people who aren't in, we're focused on food, but it's not about service. It's a different point of view. Yep. And to see people's different tastes from things they don't want on the menu, and just, I think it's a fascinating conversation.
Awesome. Well, I'm so glad that all of us are here. Thank you for your introductions. Thank you to Rebecca for putting us all here together. And then before we get started, thank you to Full Service Radio for recording this conversation. It'll be available on Tuesday, I believe, for listening forever. So let's jump into it. Lee, I'll direct this at you, but also we want this to be very conversational, so everybody just jump in as we go along. How do you approach talking about all of this in an accessible way? You brought, you know, natural wine to people, which kind of is an outside of, it was new when you were bringing it to people. So how do you approach this subject in an accessible way? How do you talk about this in a way where it's approachable and introduce this from?
I mean, I think that, you know, I've done a lot of different jobs in this business, but I think my ethos is rooted in service and hospitality. And so for me, I haven't really had a curated wine list, right? I put together selections, and so in that way I sort of implied to people what they should be drinking. But for me, it was more of an offering than anything else, a little less than John, who was more of a tastemaker and was making declarations that he had to live with. I could offer 200 wines to think about, and so there was a little less black and white, although, yes, there was a through line and there was an ethos and what have you. So I think my experience has always been, and then also, you know, clearly as a woman from color from Poughkeepsie, New York, I could never sort of have the space of dictating and telling people and or shaming them, right? So it was always really important for me to make people feel warm, to make them feel like they belonged, and to also, like, I don't know, I don't put a lot into declaring yes and no about things. So I live in the gray. I'm a little less concerned with the empirical. I think everybody can be right-ish. And so, you know, there's a part of me that's about empowering people. And so when they say a wine is sweet, which I think in my head is fruity but dry, it is my job not to go, you mean fruity but dry. Like, that's not my job. For me, that's not my job. And when I would train staffs in restaurants and hotels, that was very clear to me. I said, don't tell people that they're wrong. Just get them something that they want.
So how do you explain that to people if it's fruity but dry? We know that, right? How do you say that exact same thing?
I don't feel like that's really my job. That's not my job. It might be somebody else's job, it might be your job. That's not what I'm here to do, right? I'm here to give people delicious experiences, to make them feel great about their lives, to kind of raise them up. You know, I'll tell you a quick anecdote. A few weeks ago, I was in Texas at an event that I was organizing, and one of the coups of the experience of this, we were able to get this really great barbecue producer to come in from Marlin, Texas, to make beautiful barbecue for us at our event. And the owner of this business had very little interaction in his life with wine, so I told him to come with me, and we were going to go through, and we were going to have a wine tasting together. So the first place we stopped, interestingly enough, was Tony Couture's table. And you guys are wine folks, some of you are wine folks. When I say Couture wines, any strong reactions here? No? Yeah? Okay. But other than that, no strong reactions to Couture? Okay. Couture's wines have been a polarizing situation. And if you had asked me 10 years ago how I felt about Couture's wines, I'd be very clear that I was not a huge fan, respected who he was in the industry, but I did not like the wines. I had this man with me. Now remember, he's a barbecue master, right? He's a pit master. He's coming at it from flavors that he creates, smokiness. We all know that there's a lot of sweet and savory in barbecue, right? So Tony Couture makes wines in Sonoma that are often very rich, dark, ripe, high alcohol reds that have residual sugar, right? So this is really interesting. Sweet reds, full-bodied, bombastic, sweet reds that are high in alcohol. And I think two things happened in that moment. Number one, I got him out of my head. I got out of my head because I was residing in Charles's head, and he was tasting wines with me. And I was seeing the wine through his eyes and through the flavors that he experiences on a regular basis. And number two, I think Couture's wines are better than they used to be. They seemed really well-crafted. They seemed like they had really evolved. And so in that, you know, who's right in all those circumstances? And Charles said, these wines would go fantastically with my food. I said, these wines would go fantastically with your food. And you should probably, do you think about carrying wine? Because this Zinfandel is the wine that you should be carrying at your joint. So, you know, I just think that there are many truths that are out there for us all to kind of, experience.
Absolutely. I think that's such a good story. And I think we all draw from our experiences as a wine taster to come up with these tasting notes, and we can't just rely on one group of people to create the sphere where we get to choose that from. Like, my experiences are going to be completely different than, like, say, Genevieve's at her restaurant. I'm really interested to see how people interact with wine and food in your space, and how does that base of identity work through
the guys with children. Yes, we chatted a little bit about this last week when we were kind of getting on a similar page about the conversation we're going to have today. And something that we saw when the restaurant first opened was that a lot of people were very surprised that we had wine at all with Filipino food. They were kind of like, why do you have wine? Like, I've never had... For people who had had Filipino food before, they were like, I don't understand why you have wine. Like, why don't you just have, like, San Miguel, like, five different kinds of San Miguel beer? San Miguel is a beer that's made in the Philippines, and you see it exported all over the world. So at that time, it was a challenge for us to explain why we had wine on the menu and why we thought these wines went well with the food. And there was just, it was surprising how often there was sort of a mental block about that. You know, just the idea that certain foods go with this beverage and other foods go with this beverage. Just kind of finding ways to gently challenge that and still be hospitable. And I think very often when there are those questions in the restaurant where people are tasting something for the first time, or maybe they've never had skin contact wine before, or, you know, they've never had a wine of a certain varietal from a certain place. We work very hard to see those moments as, like, such moments of opportunity. Because I think that, when people are feeling uncomfortable or that something is pushing them out of their comfort zone, just as hospitality people, our emotional intelligence and our intuition with people is like very finely tuned. And I think that what we really enjoy is when those opportunities present themselves and we can engage in a conversation that makes someone feel comfortable trying something new. Or sometimes even that makes someone feel comfortable just saying that they want the thing that they always like to drink.
Yeah.
And having that be okay. And not having, just taking the judgment out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you ever have the opposite where it's like, oh, I'm so surprised. Like, I know Bethany is hot right now, right? So it's like, oh, I'm so surprised that they're from the opposite way. Oh, I'm so surprised. I am a wine drinker. I didn't think that I would come here and be able to have this wine with this food. Like, does it ever come? Like, I hear from people who traditionally interact with these foods, but, like, people interact with,
No one said it quite in that way. But I think sometimes when they see our wine list, which has a lot of varietals that may be new to many folks, they're like, where's the California Chardonnay, or where's the Syrah, or I've never heard of this before, why don't you have X? And so just, I think we've gotten a lot of practice at taking that conversation and figuring out a way to get them to something that they're going to be happy with their food, but it may not be the usual thing that they used to have when they go out for dinner.
Yeah, I imagine that there's a lot of just like education happening in that space all together.
And education of us too.
Yes. So, Millicent.
Yes.
We touched briefly when Lee was talking about access and exposure to things and how that kind of shapes where we fall on the line. Like she's saying, her goal is to educate and give people a good time, not to educate them about wine. But how do you interact with food and exposure when you're outside of the restaurant space? How does your position in the food world?
Do you mean like in the soup kitchen?
The hierarchy of the concept of taste and how
to
start. How do you see that from where you are?
I see that as really about being exposure and like what you're talking about, people's fears and comfort zones. And I think that where I work really highlights people's fears and comfort zones, and that fear doesn't allow for curiosity. And when you're working with people who have a lot of things to fear in their lives, like the instability of their housing or what they can afford or feeding their families and all of that, that they're not really curious about beets, there are people who will like find more things out about it, but people don't want to be challenged about that necessarily in terms of taste. But if I make something and I offer it, that's a different experience. And that's instead of me being like, you should eat this because it's good for you. Just in general, like I do, we give away bread and give away produce as part of our food pantry. And so we get a lot of rescue food, and like there's fava beans. And fava beans, if you don't know what they are, they just look like rotting beans. You're like, why would I want these? But if I make something with them, or if I show people how to show them, it's a different thing. And I think that's also where I am. It's the ultimate act of hospitality. You know, the people who come to St. John's Bread and Life we call them guests because we have a dining room, and they are people that, like, feeding people is always about hospitality. And so it's not telling people what they should eat, because the world tells people who don't have money stuff all the time, you know, but it's showing them, you know, maybe you do like this, maybe you just, you know, here's a recipe and I'm going to show you that and I'm going to show you how to make it. And so it's the same thing. It's comfort zones. Mm-hmm. And it's clinging on to your identity. And then you break out. Like I put menus and recipes for things that we give away that people don't know what to use, like kohlrabi and fava beans. And then the same people will come back and build and like get more of those things, and then they're broadening their ability to make things for their family and also just to eat, you know.
Absolutely. So, John. So, John, I know you briefly talked about knowing about wine from a very young age. What do you wish you didn't remember from that time growing up? What kind of things do you feel like were imposed on you by knowing about it early on? And as a rule writer, taste maker, person literally writing rules about how we interact with wine, how do you approach that?
In terms of what I grew up with, I don't know that there's anything I wish I didn't learn. I had this great fortune where my father, sort of as his first, sort of as a second career, trained as a chef, and so he would force all of these strange foods upon us. Strange foods. This was the 80s, so nothing was super strange, but you know, curry chicken salad, not a thing you want to bring to school. Anyway, now, but required a lot of explaining. So I don't know that there were things that I would necessarily give up, because I think one of the things that gave me was this sense that there is this much broader palette of flavors for food, for wine, that is out there, and admittedly, I think most folks don't get to grow up with that. And so by the time I was in college and forgetting about all of this and eating mozzarella sticks, I had at least a basis. In terms of how it sort of pushed forward into taste making, what I do wish in some ways that perhaps I could have either forgotten or found a better way around or a better way through was this period of time when I was being kind of quote-unquote tutored or educated on what the classics were, what the supposedly great wines of the world were or are. Not that that wasn't valuable. I think it's important to have a benchmark. But I think at the end of it, now looking back, it was, and this is where a lot of the tension in the wine world between the natural wine world and the non-natural, I don't know what you call it, but this is where a lot of the tension comes from, is that there is this temptation to say, well, natural wine is weird, and for me, as someone who has been both an advocate and a skeptic in that space, you know, weird and different is fine. Flawed and problematic is something else. And this is this difficulty where we're having this evolving conversation in the wine world between what is simply different. You know, you take white grapes and you make them like it's a red wine. That's what we get as orange wine. Yeah. You know, there's nothing inherently weird. There's nothing inherently weird about a wine that has cloudiness. There's nothing inherently weird about these things that especially stupid writers, the journalists tend to kind of like use as tropes against natural wine. Oh, it's cloudy and it's like beer. Well, yes, that's true. And cloudy beer
is delicious. There's also a spectrum of flaws, right? So what some people consider to be quirky and interesting is extremely flawed to another person.
Right. So I think if in some way, if I could have dropped anything along the way, and what you're saying, well, so the last book I wrote was literally called The New Wine Rules, the joke being that it doesn't really have a lot of rules in it. But it would have been to get rid of this sense that, you know, that wine can only taste a certain way in a very narrow realm, and that you have to learn that and only that. Because now what you see is that this enormous diversity in the world of wine is out there, and the people who felt like, you know, Dom Perignon's the best champagne in the world, it will always be, or fruit, whatever, they don't have the ability to understand the evolution of taste as it's happening.
Thanks, and that, I wish I would have been exposed and taught about... I would have been a lot of more of a confident taster starting out if I hadn't had to fit myself into that box of, like, these people who made these rules set, like...
I mean, you know, these are all different sub-languages within this world that we inhabit.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun to speak any language.
It's fun
to speak French, Italian, German in this industry because it first of all, it helps you to connect with the winemakers
mm-hmm.
and with the farmers. But it's also fun to taste, to be able to speak these different languages of evaluation as well.
Yeah.
And it just But if you can do it without judgment, then it's an olive branch instead of a separation.
Yeah, I think our issue as wine professionals comes when you try and speak Italian to a Spanish speaker without teaching.
They understand
what you're saying. You know what I mean? Like, it's a little bit similar, but you have to figure out the way you want to.
The other part of that being someone who is a Spanish speaker who's maybe learn two words of Italian. Now they know Italian flat out and will tell you exactly what they think.
Or it really has no interest in your Italian, just wants a glass of wine. So, Ralph, as an academic coming from Southern foodways and really the development of taste in these areas, how does that come into our identity as tasters?
I think it really fits in with what everyone else here has been talking about, because in the South, food is really tied in with identity. And there is also the idea of who is welcome, and the idea of hospitality. Who's welcome at the welcome table? And that has been a big issue that I work with the Southern Foodways Alliance, that we have talked about at Southern Foodways Alliance meetings. Okay, who actually prepares this food? Who actually created these recipes that we think of as part of our Southern identity? And realizing a lot of them are African Americans, because there were not that many white people cooking in these large homes. They were all black. So really thinking about that idea of welcome and realizing that when we share a meal, we share our common humanity with each other. And that was the biggest barrier in the South to changing the way that we were able to actually go somewhere and get a meal. I did not grow up going to restaurants. I grew up where we actually took our food with us. And that has been something that I have really come to as an adult. And one of the things the Southern Foodways Alliance has done is kind of demystify that idea of food ways for lots of people, and getting to see that connection between identity and food, and expanding that idea of what is Southern food as the South becomes more diverse, as it becomes browner, as you have. I'm a regular at Snack Bar in Oxford, Mississippi, and the chef at Snack Bar is Indian, and he brings a lot of Indian flavors into traditional Southern dishes. And it changes, what it is that you pair with that, what you...
Do you drink wine? Do you drink a fair amount of wine?
Yes, a fair amount, yes.
A fair amount.
Probably
entirely for me.
And wine has traditionally not been a part of the pairing with Southern food, so that has been a big change. I think it's very similar to your experience at dancing. People think, I never would have had wine with my mom's fried chicken. Maybe she was sipping a little bit of the back
end. Two things. One, fried chicken is usually a very complimentary pair to a lot of wines. But also, when it goes back to talking about who's creating these wines, these products, this food, this culture, we often forget about who's growing and picking the grapes. We often forget about, I doubt anybody's plantation owner was making wine in Virginia in the 1600s. I'm pretty sure he had help to do that and hire free help. So how do... I'm glad you brought that up, because as John was saying, the wine world can be unwoke, and we don't really talk about the whole spectrum of how wine is made, and I feel like if we understood that a little bit more, we'd be able to feel a little bit more welcomed into those spaces.
Well, I think also in the South, the other thing that we also have to talk about, particularly in Mississippi, we're in the poorest state in the Union, and we're talking about food. We have to also think about there are people who are outside this realm, who are hungry, who don't have access to food. What are those issues as well? While we're gathered talking about these very lofty ideas related to food and identity, realizing, you can go 20 miles to the west into the Mississippi Delta, and you're in a food desert. And that's a very sobering thought.
One of the things that actually frustrates, well, more than frustrates me, makes me relatively angry about wine, and I'm going to put the blame for this almost entirely on the corporate wine industry, meaning like the Kendall Jackson of the world, who sort of completely divorced wine from its origins, is that it is still an agricultural product. And even within that, I think it's important to subdivide between the way that wine is made in the United States and the way that wine is made, I'll pick France in particular, you can say this Italy, other places, which is to say, in the United States, if you want to make wine, it's not ultimately indigenous to the United States or American culture in any particular way. It's been here a long time, but it was the grapevines are European. It was all brought here in some way. And the cost of entry now to be a winemaker, however you define it in the United States, is high, which is to say it's sort of a upper middle class pursuit to a very upper class pursuit if you end up trying to buy land in Napa. By contrast, if you go, say, to France, it is still absolutely an agricultural product and it's an agricultural task, and frankly, we talk about Bordeaux, you can talk about Burgundy, but even in Burgundy, even people who are like harvesting and working in Grand Cru vineyards, the people who are making the wine are more often than not the farmers themselves. They may get some seasonal labor, but on balance, they are doing the work. It is literally their work. And for the most part, most of these folks, especially if you move out of the couple places that have some money, French vineyards are, they're at best middle class, and typically they're agricultural working class. There's, we fetishize their wines here, but these are not rich people. And the wines that we see, say, $25, $30 in the United States, these are typically leaving X seller for 5, 8 euros. And these are folks who are like trying to figure out how to make their mortgage payments. So we idolize them, but this is not fancy in the way that wine in America has come to be seen as fancy.
In fact, to expand on that a little bit, I'm very cognizant when those of us who work with wines here in the United States are very cognizant of how we host winemakers when they come over from Europe. Because people who don't know the financials of their life may think that they have a lot more money than they do, may expect them to foot the bill for certain things that they shouldn't, may expect that they can afford to eat in certain restaurants and stay in certain hotels in New York City that they cannot. So for many of us, our jobs are to try to make that entry easier so that they can come and visit, promote their wines, but very aware that these are people who, if they're doing well, and I know that this number might be a lot to some people and a little bit to somebody, but if they're doing well in smaller appellations in France, might make $50,000 a year. You know, and so they're not jetting around being fabulous.
And that's not like sitting in the tasting room welcoming people.
Right.
That's doing 10 to 12 hours a day hard work.
Yeah.
I'm glad y'all have brought that up because it's really a full circle kind of thing. I feel like when we talk about labor, I think educating people on the full process is important. And lofty, as I think Ralph said, these are very lofty goals to be able to explain to everyone. But how, because we are space makers and peacemakers, how do we create access, how do we create spaces that are welcoming of everyone's taste? Like how do we, and things that we can actually do, how do we create those spaces, how do we create that access to this world so we can expose who we while we're here.
Well, I was asked recently in an interview, what's the challenge in serving people who are sort of newly arrived to the city and people who have been living in the city for their whole lives or many years? And in some ways, I don't see it as a challenge at all, because I want to welcome everybody. And so much of what we do, every single thing that we do in the restaurant is with that in mind, with the goal of having everyone who comes in the door feel like they belong there, and every step in the meal is set up to create that feeling. So in terms of accessibility and making people feel welcome, I think it's something that in order for it to really work, needs to be incorporated into everything that we do.
So like valuing people. By valuing people, you therefore value whatever taste they bring along.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And how we greet people at the door when they first get there, to how we help them navigate a menu that may be full of things that are unfamiliar, or that may be full of some familiar things and some things that they weren't expecting to see that maybe they're surprised to see, maybe not in a positive way. And for me as a restaurateur, it's so important to me that people feel like they belong in the restaurant. However much they want to eat, if they want to drink or not, what they choose to order. And so much of what I enjoy about engaging in conversation with guests is kind of like figuring out where they are in that spectrum. And then also seeing what I can do to make them feel comfortable to put a meal together that they're going to be happy with. You know, it's so simple. But I think it also can feel complicated, especially if people are bringing certain expectations to the table about what kind of restaurant it is, or how they're supposed to behave, or what they should or shouldn't drink. I think that when we've succeeded, it's the mark of our success is when people feel comfortable just to say what they want and say what's interesting to them, and say what they think is going to be delicious, and that's all that we want for them.
And you know, here's the thing: in the wine world, some of the coolest, hippest, or the most elite and revered wines are very sweet or somewhat sweet. And so, you know, who am I to tell somebody that, well, you can have that sweet wine later, but you can't have it now. Or you can have it with this, but you can't have it with this. You know, it's who made, you know, yes, there's a tradition that put some of these things together, and we honor that tradition, and I do like to know the tradition so that I can turn them on their head. I also like to remind people that things like sweet Muscat wine, fortified sweet Muscat wine from the south of France, and we drink it in this country often as a dessert wine, but often where it's from, they drink it at the beginning of their meal as an aperitif with salty things, with savory things. And so with foie gras, with cheese puffs, right? So things that we've even, we actually mistranslate things often in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to have sweet fortified Muscat at the beginning of your meal, in the middle of your meal, or at the end, yes, that's the answer.
For breakfast.
Yes.
Well, and again, I think it's interesting, the really advanced placement wine folks tend to get to a place where that's fine, because A, you stop judging, because you're like, hey, you do you, like, that's what you want to drink, great. A lot of folks on the way to that are where you run into brick walls, because there is so much insecurity tied up in wine, there is so much fear of the lack of knowledge, and a lot of it is frankly the really bad, say bad language, but I don't mean that, the really insufficient language that has sort of grown up around talking around wine and the inability to communicate out to folks who are just curious about ways to talk that aren't going to be judged. So again, I think folks who've sort of gone through the entire trajectory, you stop making big judgments because you're comfortable with it. But there is so much insecurity, and you see it in hospitality, which is really frustrating. You see it in wine retail, probably more than anywhere else. This is not saying anything about domestique, right? but you see it. I mean, the number of times that I've been wine explained, to say nothing of how many times my wife, who is far, far more expert in wine than I am, and frankly, a much bigger deal in the industry, the number of times that we get wine spit and we go to just buy a bottle of wine is shocking, considering that none of it needs to be that way, and that we don't exactly walk in sort of looking around like we have no clue.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter, because there's this sense of insecurity that can be exploited, and that to me is the sort of the first absolute thing that has to be changed within.
Yeah, from I think a marketing standpoint and from a guest standpoint, there's a lot of genderization, a lot of why are we talking about wine like this? Or what does? I think in some ways, yes, everything that we do is tied into identity, but in some ways, it literally has nothing to do with. So just tell me what's actually in this bottle.
I think that idea of identity, like the taste of the elite aspect, like you catch someone right when they're learning about it, and it gives them a sense of security of like that they are elite, that they're in a mystical world. You know, and they can enter any wine store.
And like where power comes out, that's where insecurity is, right?
You can't enter any wine store, because even then you still get...
Well, it's power and taste. And like, what do people want now? They want to just have their jobs be their Instagram, where they're like, I'm a tastemaker just by being in a way, but like, and there's power with that to a certain extent, but there's so much power in not giving a shit. You know, that's when you get to that point when you're like, this is what I like. I cursed the library, you guys. But when you're like, this is what I like, and maybe that doesn't follow the rules, because it's really just about dismantling the systems.
I think sometimes we overthink things, too, when it comes to food and wine. And I did that one time at a Southern Foodways event where they brought in a group of Asian chefs from Houston, and they made this amazing lunch with, it was this kind of fusion of the South, and they had these Korean buns, and they had this meeting with kimchi, and I said, oh my goodness, this tastes like something I remember from when I was a kid, and I just couldn't hear what it was. He said, it's fried bologna. And I thought, oh my goodness, that's it.
Was it actually fried bologna?
It was fried bologna with a little char on it. Inside cream with a spongy bun with kimchi, and it was amazing. But the taste, I mean, I should have followed my gut, but I say, it tastes like fried bologna, but I would say it's fried bologna.
You know, remember, that's what we do in America. This is an expansion of what happened in the old world. So, of course, we would also do that with wine. You know, we're going to, yes, if we talk to our grandmothers, when we talk to the great chefs of the old country, or other countries where we all come from, there are ways to make things and there are ways to do things, although you were mentioning that sometimes there's not one way to do anything in the Philippines.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. But once you come to this country, of course we're going to flip it on its head a little bit. Of course we're going to expand upon that. That's what we do in America. That's the joy of it.
So before I throw it to the audience to give questions, our last question, I would like for everyone to answer it. What do you wish the wine world, or what do you wish on our end we knew about taste that we could pass on to people who are interacting with us?
I would like to take that really quickly and just say that one of the things that just came to me immediately is that taste changed as you evolve and as you age, right? So I'm 47. I'm not the taster I was when I was 30. I don't have the capability to taste in that way. And that also, I am quite sure that my palate is getting a little lazy, and that the things I like are just the things I like now, right? And I like lots of acidity, I like lots of freshness, I don't like too much tannin, and that's just where I am in my life, right? It doesn't mean that's all I want to drink, and there are times when I really need a beautiful Barbaresco. But there, more times than not, I sort of glom into comfort wines. And after tasting for over 15 years seriously, I'm going to give myself that even as a wine professional. So taste is not a static thing in your life. It's going to evolve and change as you go through.
Absolutely.
I think everything Lee says is right, as usual. You know, I think a lot about wine as the same as I think, and food the same as I think about music, you know, and like there were points where I was listening to like the most extreme music, like Japanese noise. You're like, why do you listen to that? It's like you want to get to like be so like something so difficult that only 10 people like it. You know? And you're like, but I'm one of those 10 people. And then that happens, certainly if you're a cook, you're like, I drink this whiskey, this is 110 proof, it's warm, it's been sitting on top of the stove during my whole shift and it's fine. And then you're like a really nice white wine from France. That's, yeah, I think that we're influenced by if it's our jobs, we're influenced by it, you know, we're totally going to like more out stuff if it's our jobs, if it's, and whoever you're around, and so it's your identity, it's growing up, and it's who, you know, peer pressure tastes.
Or wanting to be in a group.
For sure. Like, why will you try to like something more that you initially are like, no? You know, like, why are you like, I'm going to keep eating radicchio until it makes sense to you? Like, also, that's a real deal. Like, that's bad. And so when you talk about sweet, you're talking about something that your palate's like, in America because of how we eat food and how food's made, and we're like, let's go to McDonald's, it's a special time, it's my birthday, and you're like, there's sugar in this and it's delicious. So you're like, that's, I think, when people are like, I like sweet stuff, you're like, you like mass commodity capitalist driven food and you're taking for it, you know, like I like Mad Dog 2020. I mean, I don't now, but so it's,
unless you like German Riesling and then you like you pop scout.
That's probably why I started with German Riesling after I moved out of Mad Dog 2020. It's very natural.
It's a gateway drug to that. And then you know,
like,
don't lie to yourself that you're not trying and more interested in investigating things. And as food and wine become bigger and like more of a conversation, like we're more willing to try things that aren't initially something that we love, you know, and then we gain a taste for it. But that means that there's lots of people who don't have that opportunity and that they're like young or they're, you know, they're on their path too.
John, what do you wish the wine world knew more about? And I
I think what I would say is that, you know, look, especially when it comes to wine, I think in taste generally, but certainly when it comes to wine, we're all going to get out of this alive. And this is, I don't want to say a luxury, but in the overall spectrum of things, we all get clean water. We're not drinking this because we need to hydrate ourselves and it's the 19th century. This is something that is an aspect of pleasure that we can add to our lives, and to have insecurity around it, to have fear around it, to worry tons about whether it's appropriately refined is ridiculous to me. It's interesting, so I'm more or less the same age as Lee, but I've kind of ended up in the opposite place, although I think we end up getting the same things, which is that as time has gone on and I've, you know, tasted a lot, I find that I get curiouser and curiouser. And I like really exploring the ever more unusual things that are out there in wine. I find that I don't worry about, am I having my sweet Muscat in the first course? Am I drinking Mezcal because I'm in a Mezcal kind of mood? I think I sort of, maybe I have the great fortune of having lived with the rules long enough that I just don't care anymore. And so I feel like I've become a little bit more open. It's not omnivorous, it's omnivulous, which is an awful word. but willing to really taste and drink whatever I'm in the mood for and just not worry about what anyone else thinks. And I think if somehow 10% more of that could come into the wine world, we would all be so much happier.
Ralph, what do you think the wine world can take from the idea of taste? Or the food world in your instance?
I think this idea of instead of just one identity, that there are a lot of identities, and that's, I think that's something that, you know, as I'm older than everybody.
This isn't a competition.
like I am old enough to really be secure enough to realize I have a lot of identities. You know, I'm a writer, a husband, I'm a father, I'm a southerner, I have a foot in the east. You know, there are all these different identities I have. But identity is what you feel inside. And ways you express that come out in that. You can't really impose something on someone to say, this, you have to like this kind of wine to be this type of person. And that's something that I think is really, I wish the industry really did recognize. Because I do think we're often sold a bill of goods with wine, and with, because it is, it's an agricultural product, as you said. But we're also sold that there is an air of sophistication that comes with that agricultural product. Right? That's something I wish that we didn't have.
So in the, I feel like I've come a long way with regard to both of these sort of main questions you've been answering in terms of taste and identity. I've come a long way even just since the restaurant opened. And I think in the beginning I was so concerned with people's expectations and trying to anticipate all the time what they were so that we could somehow meet them. or feeling like really crestfallen when some people would come in who had certain expectations and we were like so far away from what they were hoping we would be. And for me, I think I feel the same about both taste and identity now, which is that I take great comfort from the idea that they're always in flux all the time, both for me personally as an individual, but I think also just broadly in the span, in culture, in history, like that they're these like very dynamic, like living, breathing things that are always evolving. And I think the big mistake that we can make, both with regard to taste and identity, is to think of them as these like eternal fixed things. I think that's where people really get into trouble and make trouble for themselves, is with that idea that they, and just trying to measure up against something that they think is, as you were saying, like objective, which we know does not exist, or eternal, which I think also doesn't really exist. And I also take a lot of comfort from holding multiple things to be true at the same time. I think it's so hard to feel always like you have to choose one side or another side, and I just feel like that isn't very truly representative of human experience. I feel like we're many, many things all at once, you know, like lots of different things that may seem to other people contradictory, but as soon as I feel like I can accept them, then they're not at all contradictory, you know? It's like setting up a contradiction where there doesn't have to be.
I think all of y'all pretty much said the same thing, which is taste changes. You can, like, two things at one time. Allow yourself to have that space to change, and also do not assume what other people's identities are, because of the so we literally just dipped a toe in this very, very big conversation. Now I'm going to see if anyone has questions. We've got about 30 minutes to open it up and see where y'all want to go with the rest of this time. So, anyone have questions? Cool, I'm going to go right here. First,
sure. Can you all hear me?
Can everyone hear her?
Awesome. So, is there a dish or a food item or a varietal of wine, grape that was like super influential or like a total game changer in how you saw yourselves or shaped your experience in the industries that you are in?
Just because it keeps my mind so quickly, because I have a lot of, like, it's like a dish. It's a Filipino dish that sort of has a lot of fear and shame and around it, kind of swirling around it. And it was something that made me feel, like, so embarrassed growing up. And it's this dish called Dinuguan, which is pork blood stew. And it's basically chunks of pork that are cooked in a sauce that's made of pork blood. It's got other stuff in it, like garlic and chilies and vinegar. And so growing up, I never ate it because it freaked me out. And growing up also as a kid, the way that adults talk to kids about this dish wasn't like trying to trick them to eat it, which I thought was just wrong. Like, you can call it chocolate meat, and I always felt like, I know it's not chocolate. Like, why are you trying to trick me into eating this thing? Just tell me what it is. You know. Like, so in a way, I almost stayed away from it because I felt like it was a trap. And so, sort of my shame is that I never had this dish until after the restaurant opened.
Wow.
I was kind of embarrassed to tell other Filipinos that, you know, because it really is a staple dish in the cuisine. And it...
Do you like it?
I love it. But it like has wrapped up in it so many of the hallmarks of the cuisine itself. It's got acid, it's got heat, it's earthy, it has, you know, it's really a lovely dish. And so for me, that was sort of my game changer moment because our chef wanted to put it on the menu, and I was even embarrassed to tell him that I had never had it. Like, he didn't know. And so he went to put it on the menu, and I was like, I guess I have to taste it. And then I was like, and then I also had to tell him that I had never had it before. And it was really super delicious. And it was just an interesting challenge to me. Like, I feel like in myself, I had all these complicated feelings about the food, and that dish is really just kind of a metaphor for me in a way of our whole cuisine. And this process of seeing it, having it see a wider audience, and just like all the feelings that brings up for me. And what has also been really amazing has not only been seeing other Filipinos who have had that dish in the restaurant be like, oh my gosh, I've always loved this dish my whole life, da da da. And that's like one type of like satisfying. And another type of satisfying is seeing people come in the restaurant who are not Filipino, who've definitely never had a pork blood dish in their life, order it and fall in love. Mm-hmm. And liquidly clean. And they don't have any like stuff about it, you know? They're like, it's a nice reminder to like have that practice of not getting in my own way and not getting in other people's way and just letting people have their own experience that doesn't have any strings attached. Mm-hmm.
Question. There's so much, but I'm gonna try to make it quick. It feels like the more time I spend in the restaurant industry, there's more of a dissociation between the identity of food itself and the identity it's taken on in the zeitgeist. So, for example, Danielle Solanas just did a dinner at Pioneer Works in Red Hook, which has traditionally been a low-income community. The dinner is $275. If you want to get entry into the quartermasters, that's at minimum $600 just for the introduction. Whereas, as you were speaking, you know, agriculturally, you know, it's still a low-income profession. The best bottles of wine, for the most part, are under $50 or under $100 stretch. How do we create access to traditional wine and food where it's being taken away every single day, every month? Does that make any sense?
Who's going to go for
it? I'll give a small piece of it, and I'm curious what the essence of it. I mean, the court being a good example. Expensive dinners are hard. Noma Tulu is the thing to do.
Oh, that came right to you.
Something like that, you know, my view of paying $600 to, you know, to sort of like jump through all the hoops that will, you know, put you on the alleged path to sommelierdom is don't. I think that job in particular, you see that some of the most talented people who ever had it never got formal training. And the nice thing, kind of like journalism, about the restaurant industry is that you don't have to get You don't have to get signed off on anything. You don't have to get a diploma. You don't have to get, you know, a piece of paper to do the job well. Whether you're a chef, whether you're a sommelier, front of house, back of house, whatever it is, I think now there's a little bit, one of the downsides of the general good trend of professionalism in the restaurant industry is that there is more obsession with letters after people's names, but it's not necessary. And I think there's endless examples of people who are succeeding without having to have kind of gone through these, you know, very, very expensive formalizations.
I'm a certified sommelier, and that's where I stopped. Had a lot to do with the fact that I had some really great mentors, and they were not people who sort of believed in that route of wine knowledge. Also, pedagogy is a bitch, and you learn one school of pedagogy, you sort of miss some of the others. So I think it takes, but I'm going to be honest, we're in this really crazy moment in the wine industry where being an MS, and for the rarefied few, being an MW, has a lot of cachet, and more young people who are coming through the wine industry right now feel that they have to have the pin on their lapel and feel that they have to have letters. I think you just have to really carve out, that's fine, actually, and that's fine, right? If that's what speaks to you and that's how you learn, that's fine. But I think that finding mentors, finding support systems, finding tasting groups, this is, at least in the wine professional world, this is just as important, if not more important, to developing your palate, developing your skill set. And, you know, that also, coming with that also means, like, having the confidence to carve out your own voice is really huge. I mean, but likewise, all of these meals happening in places like Red Hook and Toulouse, you know, it is upsetting sometimes, but I think that means that we also can fight to create experiences in neighborhoods that are contrary to that. You know, we can throw a goat on a spit or make some barbecue on the sidewalk, throw some pet nat in, you know, the cooler, and create a $35 experience. That's what they are. That's what, you know, all these pop-ups are like, they don't need to be $500 pop-ups in Stockholm. They can be anything, anywhere. So let's have some fun with that. It's summertime.
And I think it's a great question, because I think that there's a big separation that we're in as a society where there's, you see the aggregate of people's incomes elevating them, but they're not the 1%. But they're way more percent than a lot of us in this room, or maybe they are in this room, but like, they are also, they like beer, and they like wine, and they like restaurants, and a lot of them own them, a lot of people own them, and you see the difference. It's like, you know, there's people who can go to school, keep going to school, and get the various initials that I do not know. But there's also a lot of people, there's moves towards pop-ups. There's move towards, like, places that are small that do great things. Superiority Burger, you know, like I love going there. Like Salty, when Salty was open, like in New York, like I'm just thinking of small places. And I don't think it's that we just go to those small places, but I think that we champion them in the way that they are affordable. And I think that we discuss those things. I think that people have visions that take them somewhere and that they do something that's kind of extraordinary and out of control and insane, like what happened in Tulum. But, like, why don't we discuss more the fact that, like, I can't afford to go to Portugal, like, all the other cooks or whoever they are, and, like, do those things that are part of what seems to be the dominant language about food. You know, screw that. Like, what's the real dominant language about food? What's the place you like to go to the most? Like, what's going to cost under $50, and how do you do that? And I think that when you start coming out and talking about those things, then you find the people who are going to be your support network, because they feel the same way. But it's not a very cool thing to say, you know, at all. As I feel you all staring.
Did that answer your question?
Cool. Sorry, I'm going to go to this gentleman in the white hood. Sorry.
No, that's fine. So I guess I have kind of a sweet dry question, since I thought that was a topic. But I think part of the reason that Rebecca wanted to set this up to begin with is, if you open up an ad for wines for a particular neighborhood in Washington, D.C., there are a lot of people in the neighborhood who are interested in sweet wine. And I think in general, in the wine world, except for the rarefied Riesling drinkers, it's sweet wine is looked down upon. I've gone to restaurants in New York where it's really hot out, you want to drink a bottle of Prosecco because it's 5% alcohol and sweet. And people really, makes people really uncomfortable. Just talk a little about
that. You know, but at the same time, Petna and wines like Sardonnay Bouget are hip. So I think, you know, with, you know, there's ways to sort of like fool people, if you know what I mean. It's you know, if you offer them a Riesling, they go, I don't drink Riesling, even though we know there's a myriad of Rieslings out there that have nothing to do with being sweet. Not that there's anything wrong with that either, you know, blah, 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 blah. But some of the hippest wines that I drink are all dry. Perchetta maybe not being one of them, but you know, there are pockets where I think that there's more. And I think sometimes it's about, like, not over-explaining things. Like, you just get something cold and you put it in a glass and you give it to somebody, especially with the right food, and it's delicious, they drink it.
Yeah.
I think that's true. I think what I'm trying to make is, like, especially in the wine world, there's something wrong with sweet wine. I mean, normal people don't drink sweet wine, right?
Without milk.
I think there's so... There is this shame attached to drinking sweet wine. I'll tell my friends, because they know I'm a wine person now, right? If they come to me and they're like, oh, I like Moscato, or I like, and whatever internet thing they've read has told them that that's a bad thing. I think all of us have decidedly been like, it's okay, you can drink whatever you want to. So maybe we're not the, you know, the people are going to be like, no, we're like, open arms to this. So I think that's what he's trying to
do. I mean, one of the things that, again, I think the wine industry, more corporate than non-corporate, has done a great disservice with is not only perpetuating but really magnifying this falsehood of dryness, which is to say New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, 12 grams sugar. Typical California Chardonnay, if you look at the numbers on, let's say, Rombauer, sort of 8 to 10 grams or more of sugar. Apothic Red, which is, you know, you look at the numbers on the sale of that, and presumably dry red wine, 19 grams of sugar. If that was in Germany, that would be an out profit. So some of it is that what people are being told is dry has no actual relation to what is dry. And as I often say, because my wife probably imports more German Riesling than anyone else in the country. So the more people want to drink sweet, like, the better it is in our house. you know, there's the presumption of dryness is almost entirely a fiction. I mean, the fact that it is persisting is really one of the shortfalls, I think, of the wine industry generally. Because really, if you're spending a single second being judgy about whether someone's drinking a sweet wine or a dry wine, you need a hobby.
The other thing I would like to do is just to introduce people to the myriad of beautiful, high-quality sweet wines that exist in the market. So, yes, there are some really shitty sweet Rieslings, but then there's all of this other stuff.
Really shitty everything.
Yes, exactly. So, for me, if you can afford it, if you can afford just a little bump up or a little step up, it's about, you know what, you love Riesling? I'm on board with that. Let me show you some of these other Rieslings. Or you love Moscato? I'm on board with that. Let me show you Vera. Let me show you producers that really put their heart and souls into making great Moscato.
You know, it's also interesting. A lot of the time, the same person who's going to shame someone for their Moscato or their Riesling is the same person drinking that 14-gram Apothic Red.
Yeah.
More questions?
My question. So, more of a success than perhaps. So, Lee and John, your most exciting moment, sweet, dry, doesn't matter, two dishes recently that you had, you're like, oh my God. And then how maybe you murdered someone naturally or inorganically and not shaming them like Game of Thrones shame. More of like a positive, like, wow, they suddenly got excited about X sweet wine because they're having this dish. Was there a dish? Was there food? Was there a time that this happened?
Two dishes that I
myself.
Let's do
one. Yeah. One dish.
I'm going to let you take this. I'm not going to stop this.
I'm sort of blanking. I don't know. All of my dishes lately have been the like, you know, more or less dry dishes, for lack of a better term, which is to say...
How about Josephine and pizza when you drink last? So.
Sorry?
With pizza?
Yeah. That would be last night. So we drank some not particularly dry rosé. I drank some 6 Point, and we drank the Croce Hermitage. So, not terribly helpful. So in my super weird, you know, truly drink what you want, what for some reason is coming back to me is being in Chambéry, which is in the Savoie, which is sort of one of the, on the approach to the great ski towns of France, but it's also where both Chartreuse and Genépis are made. And at some point I discovered that Leclerc, which is kind of like the Costco of France, had artisan Genépis, which is very herbal and somewhat astringent, but also has a ton of sugar in it. They were selling it for like 13 euros a bottle.
Yeah.
And so I'm not going to lie, I spent at least 3 nights in Chambéry making like tomato sauce pasta and drinking it with Genépis, and eating with Genépis, because why not?
That sounds actually
pretty good.
More questions?
So for everyone, as professionals in your respective field, you've talked a lot about your identity and how you show up to work, how it's influenced your everything that you do. How would you handle the biases and someone else's opinion as it approaches you, whether you're on the dining room floor, you're writing? How do you reconcile the two and just say kind of forget that, that's their own opinion, and work your way through and holding on to your true beliefs?
Particularly about biases?
Maybe by, it's identity, because we have our own sense of self, and then we also have what someone is projecting on you.
Well, you know, it's something that I have to say that I've worked very hard at, and I don't necessarily succeed, but I remind myself of this daily, is I don't look at someone and think I know their story.
Right.
And I think that's probably the most important thing, and when I'm in the classroom, you know, before I start off a course for the semester, I let them know who I am. And I don't presume that they actually know, because sometimes there are judgments that are made, particularly an African-American man teaching Southern Studies about, well, is that an appropriate place for you to be? Is this an appropriate course for you to be taking? This is, so I throw those things out there at the beginning of the semester. And then it kind of dispel some of the ideas that people may have about who I am and why, whether or not I belong where I am. So, does that answer your question?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that for me, I've spent some time working at high-end restaurants in New York City as a sommelier, and I've had to make sure that I always brought the goods, because if they caught me not knowing something that they thought I should know, it kind of undermined not just my presence, but many people's presence in that space. So I've had to just make sure to do my homework. And, you know, from working with a list that's deep in Burgundy and Bordeaux, even if that's not my personal passion, to make sure I know everything on that list and what's going on and all the vintages back to 61 and everything else. And that's, you know, I mean, that's what a lot of people of color have to do in many spaces. So it's not unique to me.
Yeah, there's a confidence that comes with knowing what you're talking about, and then also understanding that anyone's perception of me is purely about them and not me. So as long as I take care of what I know and make sure that I can answer their questions, then I don't really have to worry about what your perception of me is, because I'm here to do my job.
The only thing I would add to that, in terms of my work, I have the great blessing of having a healthy ego, so I just focus on questioning myself mostly. But I think it is interesting, because there are elements, at least of service, that is one thing, the person coming to your table, but the quality, not just of the cooking, but also of a wine list, doesn't necessarily inherently come with an identity, which is to say, I drank in many of the places before I ever met Lee. I drank in many of the places where she had put wine lists together, which were amazing wine lists, and in no way was I thinking about who is the person who did this, aside from someone who really knew their wine. And so I think there is there are opportunities in addition to the direct contact that you have in hospitality where great work stands out regardless.
Thank you, John.
Thank you for all those tranquil moments.
We can take one or two more questions before we go.
Or none.
Unless not.
Yeah, I just have a small question. This is, I guess, directed at John. You earlier talked about kind of how vineyards in Napa and France operate. I was wondering if you knew kind of the current conditions in, like, South Africa, because I know that there's still, like, post-apartheid, like, labor, lots of labor issues.
Yes, there are lots of labor issues.
Yeah.
It is complicated. I mean, yes, most of the labor in South Africa in vineyards are of color. So are California, to the point that you are probably, as a white person, not really going to be allowed into the vineyard because you're not going to, you know, frankly, you're not going to be able to do the work that well. And it's pretty common now, like, you know, it's a difficult division in California. I don't know how it ever evolves, but it's just like, it's very clear now where the labor pool is. Australia, same thing. Not the same thing, but most of the vineyard labor in Australia is Cambodian and Lao. And, you know, I think it's not as necessarily as difficult as South Africa in terms of the economics, but it is largely a refugee population. The labor laws tend to be somewhat better. But it is, I mean, strangely, it is Europe where typically you don't have that divide nearly as starkly.
All right. Well, if no one else has questions, I want to thank, or do you all have anything you want to leave with or leave the audience with before we go? Well, thank you all so much for...